What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson.
I studied exercise physiology and competed in many various sports ranging from wrestling to ultra running. I use that knowledge to combine today's science with ancient wisdom to live an optimal lifestyle and to spread that information onto the masses.
I'm a lifelong weightlifter and I'm obsessed with health and wellness. My degree in biology, with an emphasis in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior, allows me to take a deep dive into the most current literature and bring that information to you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to show your support, please rate and review on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or SoundCloud. Also, sign up on our website, tntwellnessandnutrition.com, for all of our up-to-date content.
Let's get this started. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 58. Today, we're going to be talking about how cooking affects our food. We're going to be going into how it affects carbohydrates, proteins, fats, and then in vitamins and minerals as well. Very interesting stuff, in my opinion. I actually had a good time looking into this stuff. But first, let's do a quick check-in. So, Tom, how's your week been?
So, it's pretty much the last, 2 weeks ever since that race. You know, I've, really fallen off.
Really?
Well, I knew I was taking a break. So this break is supposed to be me, focusing. I'm calling it, my working in phase. Focusing on just relaxing, doing some yoga, some, mindfulness, that type of thing. Really haven't gotten in the groove of that yet. Because it's so out of my, my norm. I do yoga occasionally, but that's normally, a recovery thing, not a daily thing. So trying to work that into my daily routines, just, not really working.
Yeah.
I've been kind of struggling with that. And since I'm not training for anything, my mindset around food isn't ideal.
So it's more lax?
A lot more lax. Yeah. And you know what? It's one thing that I think is really making it go a lot longer is I'm eating food that I used to love and none of it tastes good.
Like what?
So I did cereal the other day. Didn't enjoy it at all.
See, because that sounds great to my mind.
It sounded amazing to me, too. Yeah. To the point where I was in the store, I was like, you know what, screw it, why not? Usually that why not is, oh, hey, I have a race, but I just have nothing going on for a while. Mm-hmm. So I tried it, wasn't good. I mean, I ate it anyway, but I think that's why. I'm not getting that enjoyment out of it like I thought I would. Mm-hmm. I went to one of my favorite sandwich spots, got my old favorite sandwich, didn't taste good at all. Just a lot of these things that I haven't had for the longest time, and none of it's tasting good. So I think, I don't know if I'm a drug addict trying to fix that itch, so I keep going back for more and more, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, it's weird.
So one thing I've been doing the last few days to get my mindset back is I've been looking up races, trying to find hey, what's the perfect 100-mile race I want to do next year? So that way, once I get that done, I'll find the next two races I want to do to prep for it. That way I can just kind of get my routine back in order and just have all my goals set. And just once I have my goals set, then I think it should be a lot easier to get back in the routine. See, I'm working towards this.
Yeah.
Because right now I'm looking at these last 2 weeks, not as my working in phase. It's just a worthless time, just a break.
Wasted?
Yeah, just wasted. So I'm going to do 2 months of working in. So that hasn't started yet.
Jeez.
So I'm looking at maybe mid-November is when I'm going to start my training again.
Okay.
Which most likely will mean it'll be after the holidays. Or not after the holidays, but after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, before Christmas, hopefully.
Yeah, so somewhere around then is when I'll really get that whole thing started.
Well, that kind of sucks.
Yeah. So, I've been looking at two of them.
Okay.
These are the two that I'm kind of debating. One is a loop course. It's in LA. It's in June. So, it should be kind of hot, but LA compared to up here is not hot at all.
Yeah.
It's a 2.5-mile loop.
Okay.
And it's a 24-hour race. So I have 24 hours to run 100 miles, which is a little over a 4-mile-an-hour pace, completely flat, but it's a loop course. So I'm going to run that loop 40 times.
That's a lot.
I don't know. Am I going to go crazy doing that?
Probably.
That's the downside with that, but, it seems plausible.
Yeah.
The other one, I don't have a great estimate on the elevation of it, but it's a 34-hour cutoff. No, take that back. It's a 30-hour cutoff.
Okay.
So you got an extra 6 hours, and you run all over Southern California. You start in, Riverside, and you end up in Santa Monica. So you do, the first 50 miles is running from, inland to the coast, and then the next 50 is straight up the coast.
Okay.
So that one should be relatively flat. I'm like, I'm excluding all the crazy trail ones because those are way too hard.
Yeah, not there yet. Yeah, I think your first one should be a loop one.
I like the loop idea, but it has that shorter cutoff. And I'm like, am I going to go crazy running this?
But just think, if you're not going to make it at 24 hours, are you going to grind it another 6 hours the following day if you do that, like 50 to the coast and 50 up the coast?
Well, just having that extra 6 hours, mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's going to help out a lot.
You think literally, like, or psychologically?
Well, I mean, like, I might need it. I don't know if I'm going to make 100 miles.
In 24 hours?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, 100 miles in 30 hours is, like, a 3-mile-an-hour pace, a little over a 3-mile-an-hour pace. That's a walk. It's a brisk walk. I can maintain that, I think, for 100 a day. Miles.
Yeah.
Four, like, a little over 4 miles an hour is, like, a very, very fast walk or, like, a slow jog, mm-hmm. which is going to be a little bit more difficult. But I do like the idea of a loop. That way, if shit does go down...
You bail.
Like, I'm right there.
Yeah, you're
there. I'm not going to be any more than, a mile and a half from, like, the aid station.
Exactly.
So that's kind of what I'm leaning towards. But I'll have less time to train for the one that's at loop course versus the other one.
How much time?
I believe it was 2 months. Let me double check.
Well, that's actually a lot of time. Yeah.
Where is the time? No, I take that back. It is 4 months.
Well, 4 months is even more time. Yeah.
It's middle of June versus middle of October.
Well, I don't know. I vote for the loop course.
Okay.
I do. Yeah. I think if you're not going to make it, I don't think you're going to bail at the 24-hour mark. I think you're going to bail like the 18-hour mark. And at that stage, it's not going to matter.
I mean, it does seem a lot easier on like my support crew.
Yeah.
Because then it's just like, oh, hey, just wait here. Like, there is one in San Francisco that I do love the setup of it, but it's an even smaller loop. It's a 1-mile loop. Okay. And I will definitely go crazy if I have to run that bitch 100 times.
Yeah. That one that Zach Bitter did, how big was that loop, do you know?
I mean, that's an indoor track.
So it couldn't be that big?
No,
I can't. Max a mile?
Yes, probably something along those lines.
Okay.
I think it was like a speed skating like rink that he was running around.
Okay.
I think that's what it was for. So maybe it is a little over a mile.
Okay.
But I mean, it's, you know,
air. Any bigger than that, it couldn't be inside.
He's not going to be running for 24 hours. He did 12 hours. You know, I'm going to be doing double that amount of time.
Yeah.
Without a bunch of people there, like, cheering me on, riding bikes along with me, like, doing all that stuff. I'm not going to have that type of support.
That's true. Yeah. It's going to be some lone soldier type shit.
Yeah. So I'm kind of not really sure. I mean, the one that goes all around Southern California does seem pretty cool. Because that way, when I go down and visit, I'm like, oh, hey, you know, that's too far. Bitch, I ran that. It's not far.
Yeah, that's true. That's
so true. That's kind of like, you know, just being able to do that. The downside with that one is there's no aid stations. So you have to solely, like, rely on your crew. So I need to have, like, a solid crew to be there to support me for 30 hours.
Yeah, bro. That's a lot to ask.
But, I mean, like, running around, like, this, because it's all through the city,
mm-hmm.
like, all through different towns and stuff. So finding, like, lighting and stuff, like, that's not going to be an issue. Like, I don't have to worry about training in the dark because it's going to be running by streetlight.
Yeah, it's L.A.
Like, that's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Or running on a beach path, it's just straight flat, like, no issues there. So that's kind of nice. And then I just need to have somebody kind of follow me in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Not, like, driving 2 miles an hour behind me, but... Oh, hey, just, like, meet up at all these, like, certain spots.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, I'm going to need water soon, like, or a refill, something like that.
No, there's going to be a lot of hurdles and a lot of, like, technical things to figure out before you do that. But, I don't know, you'll know way more after you do your first, like, 2 prep races next year.
Yeah.
Then you'll really know what you need and what pace you can do. And I think if you can keep that 4-mile-an-hour pace, just do the indoor one.
It's not indoors.
I mean, not indoors, but the loop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you can't keep that pace, then yeah, maybe do the long one.
Well, because the long one, I could just walk.
Yeah, those are still crazy events, though. Yeah. Doing anything for 100 miles is... I don't even know if people really appreciate the scale of that. So, like, if someone says, oh, I ran the Boston Marathon. It's like, fuck, man, it's a big race. How many miles is that?
26.2.
So, we're talking almost 4 times that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, it's a lot. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
Yeah, and I also don't know how I would do running on pavement for that long.
Just just your feet.
Yeah,
because they're gonna get fucked.
Because I don't train on pavement really.
It's gonna be hard.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that is another thing that could pop up. And especially, I'm not gonna run anything close to that for a training run.
No, God no.
Like my longest training run I'm gonna do is 100K before that.
Really? How long is 100K miles?
62, 64 or something. Shit. I'm not good at that conversion, but
even that's yeah. too long. But okay, yeah. I was thinking like 50 miles. But all right.
Yeah, so I plan on doing a 50K. Early next year, probably like February, March, then somewhere around April, May, get a 100K, and then if that goes well, then I'll look at doing a 100 miler.
Okay.
Unless I'm going to do the one that's in October, and then I can kind of push everything back.
Let's not push it back, all right? Yeah. You already pushed 2 weeks back. Let's stop pushing things back. Yeah.
So that's it with me. What's new with you?
This week I'm home alone. My wife's gone. She's in Costa Rica for a week. Did you know that?
For a wedding, right?
Did I tell you that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, she went out there for a wedding, and well, kind of a wedding. Like, they got married in a courthouse last week. I went to that part, but yeah, they're just going out there for like the whatever ceremony part, and definitely didn't go. Could not pay me to get on a plane for 14 hours. You know, straight.
It's that long of a flight?
Well, I think it's broke up in two separate flights.
Like, okay.
Yeah, but long as shit, way too long for me. Yeah. You know, I'm definitely not doing it. And so yeah, as far as anything else with new with me, not much, man. I had a real good time. Like, I don't know. I guess to let you little insight into me. Like, I'm not a good person to watch movies with, because I always want the good guy to win every time. Like, I don't want any sort of tension. I don't want any sort of drama. Like, I just want, here's the bad guy, here's the good guy, and, like, everything works out. And that's not a good movie. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, good movies have tension. I don't like that shit, right? Hey, guess what? The world's bad enough as it is. I don't need to watch these dumbass drama movies, okay? So, when I read, like, papers like this, looking up just, like, the history of fire and just the history of human evolution, I don't know how many times, like, carnivory and meat-eating came up. I mean, it comes up all the time in these papers, and I was like, it just, like, reassured me. And not that I needed to be reassured, but just as far as a dietary path that I'm currently on, like, man, the evidence is, like, fucking ironclad. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, we are meat-eaters 100%. So I really had a good time looking into all this stuff. You know, it was pretty cool.
Well, most of these papers that you were looking through were, like, for anthropology, not biology or, like, nutrition.
Yeah, good luck trying to find the word carnivore in a nutrition paper.
No.
You're not going to find it.
Yeah, but, like, if you really want to look how we should be eating today, it's how we've always been eating.
Yes.
And, like, that's all the anthropology stuff.
And if you talk to anybody like that who does that sort of research, they'll say humans are carnivorous creatures. Like, it's not even up for debate.
I remember my friend sent me an article saying, like, it was an anthropology paper, and, like, the headline of it was evidence of, like, an ancient tribe that was vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
So I read through it, and that's not what it said. It said that they couldn't find evidence that they ate meat,
mm-hmm.
which is not the same thing as them being vegetarian. Just because the evidence isn't there doesn't mean that they didn't do it.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of threw back at, like, a couple obvious things. It's like, look, if they were eating meat, they'd be eating insects, which is, I think, the same thing.
It's close.
There's no way they would be able to survive one winter at all without meat.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't be able to get fat enough to fast through one, more or less get through hundreds or thousands of winters to be able to reproduce and actually have a population.
Yep.
Like, there's just no way around that. And, like, there's nowhere in the world that people have access to meat and, like, willingly just
avoid it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just so much evidence against it. I was like, this just makes no sense.
I know.
And you, like, try to argue with me about it, I just kind of gave up on it. I was like, this is pointless.
But that headline sounded good to what he believed in.
Yeah, and, like, the paper didn't support that.
Yeah.
Either. It's like,
did he read the paper?
Probably. Because it wasn't a very long one.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, look, like, no evidence doesn't mean the same thing. Because I don't really know how you do have evidence that people ate meat when you just have half a skeleton.
Yeah, it's I mean, there is evidence as far as, like, finding broken bones and stuff like that, but yeah.
Yeah, like, I just don't know exactly how that stuff works. I'm not into that carbon dating or whatever they do. That's a whole nother field.
It is, yeah.
So, yeah, let's get into the topic.
Yeah, we should. So, the first thing I really looked into was there's an argument that cooking meat and just cooking in general kind of turned us into being human. So what really distinguishes us from other just mammals is our brains are stupid big. And that's a good word to describe our brain, huh? But it's what separates us, right? We're just smarter straight up. And so there was an argument that cooking was one of the reasons our brains grew so large in comparison to other just creatures of the time. But it turns out that's probably not true. Actually, it's not true, just straight up. So I pulled this from the paper. It's titled Human Brain Expansion During Evolution is Independent of Fire Control and Cooking. And so they showed, here's a quote, "We show that large primate encephalization, which is just increase in brain size, was reached millions of years before the widespread control of fire, a prerequisite for cooking, and provide evidence indicating that early hominins were likely to obtain enough calories from raw meat to afford for the size of their brains." We've ate meat raw longer than we've ate meat cooked. So that's really the thing that they got from that.
And just to develop the skills of being able to control fire and then figuring out you could cook with it, I would think since we're the only ones that do that on this planet, that probably takes a lot of brain power. You have to be pretty smart to be able to do that.
Yep.
So I'm guessing like that raw meat gave them enough nutrients to develop a big enough brain to even come up with that idea.
Exactly.
Or else we'd see wolves or apes or some other creature out there doing it. And yeah, we don't.
Exactly. That's very true. Yeah, and I pulled, like I talked about earlier, all these quotes from these studies showing about humans being carnivores. I pulled a few quotes just because I just think they're so great from these studies. And I'll link all these studies on the website like we always do. So if you want to read them, they'll be there. But here's a few quotes. So from an ancestral condition that must have been largely or even exclusively vegetarian, which is true. Like you go back millions and millions of years, you were apes living in the forest, eating plants and fruits. Hominid diets shifted toward substantial amounts of meat eating. Facultative or true carnivores tend to have relatively longer small intestines where the digestive and absorption of animal products occurs, and a relatively shorter large intestine and cecum. Does that make sense as far as our biology? How are our GI tracts laid out?
Exactly like that, which is completely different from like a gorilla, which would have the opposite. It'd have a short small intestine and a very long, large intestine. That's why even like a lean gorilla, it'll have a six pack, but it still has like a beer belly underneath it.
Yep.
And that's because of their very long, large intestine. And that gives them the ability to break down fiber and be able to get all the fat from that fiber, yep, the short chain fatty acids. So like, that's kind of how that system works, which ours is not the same.
Not the same at all. So when you hear that dumb bullshit argument, which I hate, I just recently heard it too, that, hey, gorillas don't eat meat and they're big and strong. Horses eat grass and they're lean and muscular. I'm like, you dumb bitch. Like, it's just our GI tracts are not built that way. No. We don't have the capacity to ferment. We really don't. It's very limited. So
I used to think that way. And then you showed me like a chart of how wolves, humans, and apes compare. I think it was chimpanzees were the other animal.
Maybe, yeah.
And ours is almost identical to a wolf.
Yes. And like, they're like, 1-to-1.
Yeah, and I was like, okay. Like, that was pretty much all the evidence I really needed. I was like, all right, well, that's pretty much it. Like, what else do you really need?
Yeah, exactly. No, the evidence is there, man. You can't deny it. Yeah. So this was the last quote, what I thought was just awesome. So, on the whole, the evidence suggests that carnivory probably first occurred in Homo erectus. The least that can be concluded is that this species shows a set of traits that match those that would be expected in a herbivore-to-turned-carnivore. So, like, the word carnivore is used literally in all these things. But I swear to God, you try and find the word carnivore in any sort of, like I said, dietary nutrition articles, you'll never see it.
No, I mean, that seems like completely taboo until, like, a few years ago. Mm-hmm. When, like, Sean Baker is the first person that I know of that was talking about this.
Yeah.
I know Michaela Peterson, I think Amber O'Hearn have been doing this a little bit longer, promoting mm-hmm. it. But, I mean, that's still very, very rare.
Very rare. Yeah. But it's everywhere, man, in these papers. It's, like, so common. So there's really strong evidence that early humans started eating meat 2.5 million years ago. So animals were defleshed and large bones were broken open to presumably extract the bone marrow. And just think, bone marrow, you love bone marrow.
Oh, it's delicious.
Yeah, I think that shit's gross. But it's a great source of super dense calories. It's all fat.
I think it's 97% fat, and you're getting a great amount of like omega-3 fatty acids from it.
All the great stuff our brains need to grow. So it makes sense that would be the trigger to honestly induce brain growth that we see in humans. So, but the thing is, 2.5 million years ago, they have evidence for that. The earliest known strong evidence for fire use is 790,000 years ago. And actually, they burn nuts. There's actually no evidence that they actually cooked meat. And this was in Israel. And I think this is funny. We talk about what should you do with nuts before you eat them.
Well, one is like to soak them in like salt water, then rinse them. And then after that, you're supposed to cook them.
Yeah.
So they knew that they were supposed to cook them so long ago.
Yeah. We're talking, I mean, it's almost 790,000 years ago. People are, I mean, they weren't technically humans back then, but our early ancestors were smart enough to be like, hey, these nuts, man, they kind of mess with my GI tract when I eat them raw. Maybe I'll cook them. And how many dumbass people do we see eating like raw almonds and raw whatever, macadamia nuts all the time?
Oh, no, like they're all over the place.
All over the place.
And I'm just thinking like, I really don't know what's better. I don't eat either one, but is it better to eat like an almond that's cooked in like sunflower oil or a raw one?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, I don't really know which one's better. I just don't eat either one. Just don't eat either. Both, but like, just kind of out there. Those are like pretty much the two ways you're going to get them.
That's true. Yeah. But so it's generally accepted that true widespread use of fire happened around 450,000 years ago by Neanderthals. But by this point, our brains had already expanded greatly. Like if Neanderthals showed up around like nowadays, you would honestly just look like probably like an NFL running back, like a short, stocky dude with a big ass head, you know?
Well, I think of like Wolverine from X-Men, like short, but just really ripped and yes. Like buff.
That's yeah. Yeah, you can think of them like that. So they're like, pretty much already like us.
Like 5'2", but just like 200 pounds of yep. Just straight muscle. Like mm-hmm. That's what they were.
That's pretty much what they were. Yeah, exactly. So the theory that cooked meat yields more energy than our early ancestors used to expand their brain like really doesn't add up. It just doesn't. So from a pure like caloric standpoint, cooking can reduce calories by rendering the fat. And it ranges depending on like the cut of meat. So for something like beef, you're going to lose about 4% of total calories from cooking. So just think when you cook like a ribeye in a pan, that fat that renders, that's going to be about 4% loss. Something for chicken, like chicken with the skin, you're going to lose around 10%. So that's a pretty big reduction in overall fat content.
Oh, definitely. I mean, 10%, if you're talking about a 1,000 calorie like piece of meat, then you cook 10% out of it. Now that drops it down to 900. That's mm-hmm. a pretty significant difference.
It is.
Yeah. And just kind of mentioning, talking about that, the way you cook it is greatly going to change that.
Yeah.
Like, if you're grilling something, then, you know, everything can just go right through the grill.
You're not going to catch that.
Yeah. Cooking it like a steak, I like to sear my stuff first, get it like a nice tight sear, and then I'll like slow cook it after that. And I lose a lot of less like liquid.
Because it sears it all in, yeah.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's a lot of fat and it comes out juicier.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming there's a lot less fat loss that way. Yeah, that's another thing with this is there's so many different variables. The cut of meat, how fat it is, and then like how you cook it. That's going
to
change it.
Yeah, and it's funny. Tom had to look up exactly what these papers meant by cooked, right?
Oh, yeah, one study just said cooked, and then it was like cooked versus canning versus frying versus microwaving.
And like those are all cooking.
I'm like, all those are cooking, so what the hell does cooking mean? And like one study meant cooking is boiling. I'm like, why couldn't you just put boiling? It's the same amount of letters.
Yeah. So we want to tackle we'll first go over like the macronutrients. So what happens when we cook carbohydrates? So there is clear evidence that cooking starch-based foods greatly increases the digestibility and the energy yield of the food. So think of, you know, potatoes, wheat, bread, stuff like that. So using ileal digestibility, and the ileum is, that's the end of our small intestines. So anything past that point reaches our large intestines. And as far as absorption for our own sake, like our own bones, body, muscle, it doesn't really matter. Once it hits our large intestines, it gets fermented for the bacteria in our large intestines, and it's not going to be really used for us. Some of the byproducts will be, but the vast majority of it won't be. So if you're going to measure digestibility of something, you want to measure it at the ileum. So that's why I pulled these studies that did measure it there, because they're the most accurate and the most kind of representative of what we're actually looking for. So raw wheat gets a score of 70% absorbed. Potatoes get a score of 50% absorbed raw. So over half the calories from potatoes you're simply not going to get if you have them raw.
So is this calories or is this carbohydrate?
This is strictly carbohydrates.
Okay.
Yeah. So cooked starch is used very efficiently, though. So like wheat, potatoes, cornflakes, white bread, all those get a score of over 90% absorbed by the time it hits our ileum. So the thing, it goes from either 70 to 50 to over 95%. So a huge difference. And the process of making starch more digestible through cooking is a process called gelatinization. So starch inside plant cells come in dense packages of stored glucose called granules. When granules warm up, they begin to swell. Or they swell because hydrogen bonds in the glucose polymers weaken and their tight crystalline structure becomes loosened. So by about 90 degrees Celsius, the granules break up into fragments and the glucose chains are unprotected and gelatinized. And so this happens whenever starch is cooked. And the more starch is gelatinized, the more easily enzymes can reach it and therefore completely digest it. Therefore, cooked starch yields more energy than raw. And this is, we talk about back in the day, just the education we've both kind of taken upon ourselves. And you look back at the things we did when we were younger, how dumb it was. Do you remember, I know I did this, putting raw oatmeal into like protein shakes?
I never did that.
Fuck, I did. You know what I mean?
That sounds disgusting.
Oh, but it's just, it was all about, you had to get your carbs, you had to get your fiber. And now I'm just thinking, like, all of that shit was just going through my GI tract. I wasn't even absorbing any of it. Like,
oh, no, not at all.
It's, but you just, no one says that. Like, how come no one talks about that, you know?
Do you think the increased bioavailability of this has anything to do with, like, some of the anti-nutrients getting destroyed through cooking, too?
I do think that, yeah. Okay. 100%, yeah.
I didn't see that really mentioned in any of the studies that neither I came across. They were probably already looking at a shit ton of information. Why bother looking at that, too?
A whole other variable.
But that was definitely something that crossed my mind.
Yep, me too. Yeah, cooking with plants is, it's just, it's clear as day. If you see any, like, I obviously am not a fan of veganism, but, like, a raw vegan is way worse than, like, a cooked vegan. And you hear, like, raw vegetarians. It's just, it's... The evidence is out there. Like, you just, our bodies cannot sustain enough energy, enough nutrients, enough vitamins and minerals from these raw diets, especially when you're doing a plant-based diet, because cooking plants greatly increases their bioavailability. Just does. So,
you know what's really funny is about probably like 10 years ago, if you asked me what is like the gold standard diet, like I probably would have said like a raw vegan. Yeah. And I'm willing to bet like if you ask the general population, they would probably say like a raw vegan diet. It's like as good as it possibly gets.
It's unprocessed. It's natural.
Yeah. And it's probably couldn't be farther from the truth.
Couldn't be farther from the truth. Yeah.
It's better than the standard American diet. Probably. But maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe not. Yeah. It depends on how you do it. Yeah. So, yeah. It's funny. Somebody recently talked to me about the vegan, just like narrative stuff. Right. And I was like, there is nothing healthy about being a vegan. I said, there are healthier ways to do veganism. But I don't care how you cut it. There's nothing healthy about being vegan. That's what I said.
Yeah, it's nowhere near optimal.
Nowhere near. Yeah. So, okay. So now those carbohydrates, you definitely get a benefit from cooking carbs. Don't eat raw potatoes. It's pointless. But
now, I don't even think you could eat a raw potato.
You don't think so?
I mean, they're pretty damn hard. Like, if you were to, you could use that as a brick if you need to break a window, like a raw one.
That's true. Yeah.
I don't know if I could bite into that.
Yeah. You just cook all that stuff, man. Any starch-based stuff. If you want to actually use it for fuel, cook it. So, all right, now we looked into meat. So, honestly, there's a lot less information on cooking, like how cooking affects meat. And I know you noticed that too. For whatever reason, there's not a lot of data out there on just meat digestion, meat processing, all that stuff.
Well, I don't know why. I don't know if it's because nobody wants to look into the benefits of meat. And instead, they have all these, like, shitty epidemiological studies with meat and point out how it could be potentially maybe bad for you.
Yeah.
But there's nothing, like, really showing the benefits. And if you show, like, cooking meat, all you're going to come across are, oh, hey, it's pretty damn good.
This is great. Yeah, I know. It's weird. There might be some sort of, underlying tones there that aren't kind of nefarious.
Well, you need funding for it, and I don't really know who's going to fund it.
Exactly. You know, that's a good point, too.
Step up, McDonald's. Come on.
Yeah, please do. I know you always say that. I'm waiting for them to do that. I know. So there are some mice studies that show cooking meat leads to weight gain. There's a few out there. But there's also a couple studies that show cooking meat doesn't lead to weight gain in mice. And these studies were only, the ones I looked at were done for like 4 days. And I don't know, I just didn't, I didn't find the information conclusive to say specifically cooking meat will lead to more weight gain, either through more calories or less digestive cost with cooking meat. So I don't know, there's a little, it's kind of 50-50 as far as that opinion goes.
Well, that doesn't make sense because we talked about earlier, you're losing calories from cooking it.
Yeah, but I'll talk about it more like level, I think, 0.4 in a little bit as far as decreasing the amount of energy it costs to digest it. Maybe okay. That makes up the difference in calories lost. Now, none of the papers said that's conclusive. They said more information needs to be put out. So, but I do think there are some advantages to cooking. And I posted 4 here. So I'll just read this quote. Our review of the diffuse and largely indirect literature suggests several mechanisms by which cooking might increase the energy available from meat. These include increasing food intake through positive effects on palatability related to texture and flavor, rendering proteins more digestible through denaturization, lowering the cost of digestion through food softening, and reducing immune upregulation by eliminating foodborne pathogens. So let's go over all 4 of those first. So the first one is positive effects on palatability. And that's pretty straightforward. Like, do you want to go eat a raw ribeye?
No, definitely not.
Definitely not.
We talked about this earlier, just on, like, raw eggs and, like, the whole Rocky movie and how he used to do raw eggs. So, funny story about that. Yeah. It's the very first time I tried it. I think I was in high school at the time. Poured 3 raw eggs into a glass, put them in my mouth, just tried to drink them all straight, just like how Rocky did. Got them in my mouth, tried to swallow. Once I got to the yolk, I like, nope, just not staying down. Luckily, I was right next to the stove and I had a pan there, so I just spit the eggs into the pan and then just cooked them.
That's so gross.
There was just no way. It was either vomit all this stuff up or do it that way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess I baby bird like some food for myself. I mean, I guess it is kind of nasty.
Yes.
But, I mean, I ate it myself, so it's fine.
Yeah, who cares?
If I made those eggs for you or somebody else, I'll do that.
No, yeah, that whole raw egg thing, man, is a trip. I've never done it myself, thank God. But
yeah, I never tried it again. I was like, nope, it's not even worth it.
Yeah, not happening. But yeah, in animal models, when given a choice, animals tend to go for cooked option over raw options. And cooking changes meat texture and flavor, making it more palatable, right? Just making it a little bit softer. And the process called Maillard reactions. And that's something, like, if you think of grill marks on a steak, that kind of, like, charred part, that's a Maillard reaction.
I think it's Maillard.
Is it Maillard?
I think so.
Oh, thank you. I've been pronouncing it wrong for fuck ever. So the 2 L's is pronounced as a Y?
I think it's, like, French or something else.
I'm saying Maillard. Oh, okay. Yeah.
You're dumbass American.
Yeah, I know. So the Maillard is how you're pronouncing it?
Maillard.
Okay, so the Maillard reaction, so that's the grill marks, and that produces that kind of like that signature meat flavor and also the aroma. And we all know that aroma and smell is a big part of eating. You know, something smells good, you want to eat it. That actually causes us to eat more or at least want more of cooked meat. So that's a big part of it.
And honestly, I don't know if there's anything that smells better to me than like walking past somebody that like cooking steak. Like if you're just walking down the street and you just smell like somebody barbecuing some burgers or some steak, that smells so good.
Like, yeah, you're instantly like hungry.
Yeah, but like just if I take out some steak and just put it on the counter, just some raw steak, that don't smell that good.
No, it doesn't.
That's not making my mouth water or anything.
Yeah, exactly. So that cooking does increase that. So, you know, probably eat more meat through that. And the second point was rendering protein more digestible through denaturing. And talked about eggs earlier. This actually talks about raw eggs. So in one human study, they measured the protein digestibility of raw versus cooked eggs. And again, they measured it in the ileum, which is where you want to measure it. And little side note, all the soy, I have to talk about soy, I think, every podcast. All the soy measures, as far as the protein scale, the PDCAAS scale, they measure protein at our colon. Who gives a shit about that, right? That's a bad part to do it. So if you measure any sort of, if you want to check like protein digestibility, look at the DIAAS scale. It's Digestible Indispensable Amino Acid Scale. That measures protein digested at the ileum. So side note, soy is whack. Don't do that. But So again, they measured the egg content at the ileum. Cooked eggs got a score of 91 to 94%, which is to be expected. We all know, me and Tom both preach that eggs are a great, great source of protein. They always score the top of the list. But raw eggs only got a score of 65%. So cooking increased the protein value of eggs by almost 40%. That's pretty big.
So that raw egg experiment, I guess, worked out pretty good for me.
Yes.
Because I guess there really is no purpose of doing raw eggs.
No purpose at all. Yeah, it's crazy.
I guess my body knew that. At the age of 16, my body was smarter than I was up until, like, I did this research.
Exactly, yeah. So the reason why this is protein comes in a complex string of amino acids. So you can think of this kind of like a ball of yarn. And in order to be digested, we need enzymes to go in there and reach these amino acids and break them up into small peptides, di- or tripeptides, because how our GI tract absorbs them. So cooking loosens this ball of yarn, opening it up, and allows our digestive enzymes to better break down the protein fully. So that's just kind of how it works. That's why cooking and denaturing proteins can kind of be beneficial.
It's just like pre-digestion, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, we talk about ancient knowledge a lot. Like, I think you say ancient knowledge in our intro, right?
Yeah.
You know something you say? Yeah, so
combine the old times with the new, which seems like something that nobody does anymore.
I know, it's crazy. So just looking at some of the more ancient societies and, like, Aboriginal peoples, like, what did they do with their food? So specifically, some of this comes from the book called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. I just stumbled on this book doing research for this podcast, and it was actually a very interesting book. I didn't finish all of it. I didn't have time, but I read through the sections, at least on food. And this guy talked about, do you know how to pronounce that name? Yagbag Hunters?
Yagab? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't pronounce shit, apparently. But the Yagbag Hunters, hunter-gatherers of Tierra del Fuego, am I white as shit? Sure am. Would bore holes into eggshells, bury them at the edge of the fire, and turn them until they were hard-boiled. So there's just a common narrative that these ancient people always ate their food raw. And these are multiple examples of these ancient peoples not doing that. So there's another example. Australian Aboriginals would do the same thing to emu eggs. They would put them in hot sand and ash until they were fully cooked. And the Inuit, which are often cited as eating raw meat, didn't. They straight up did not eat a lot of raw meat. They actually boiled most of their meat to well done. So some things they did eat raw, like they ate rotten fish that they left out for like weeks or months. They would eat that raw, and they would also eat liver raw. And that makes sense. If you cook liver, which me and Tom both do a lot, liver is very, it's honestly kind of slimy and raw and soft as it is. So you could easily eat liver raw and not worry about texture. You can just kind of swallow that shit easy. But the majority of the food that the Inuit eat was actually cooked. So the narrative that these like ancient societies cooked, or excuse me, ate a lot of their meat raw isn't true.
Well, I don't understand why they would eat rotten fish, like week-old rotten fish raw.
Weeks or months old.
Yeah.
Yeah, they would.
Mm-hmm. That part doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it was like a delicacy type of thing. Yeah. Well, it was just a way to, they would store it out. It's like, if you don't have fridges, they would just leave it outside.
So, I mean, is that kind of like fermented or something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can think of it just like that. Think of it like a fermented fish. Yeah.
There is, like, I know a delicacy, I think it's in Scotland, where it's like, it's some sort of shark that they, it's rotten shark.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about too, yeah.
And if you've never tried it before, like, you're most likely going to say it's the most disgusting thing ever, and it's like has one of the worst smells ever, but it's like a huge delicacy. If you're like from over there, they love it.
Yeah, if you something you ate as a kid, you liked it.
Yeah, it's something that I've heard before that just, to me, that sounds gross. I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, no shit, me either. Yeah. Okay, so the third point is lowering the cost of digestion. So we've talked about this before. What's something that Paul Saladino says as far as protein calories go, like, your body really doesn't want to use them?
Well, like, when we think of calories, it's a measurement of energy.
Yeah.
But protein isn't used as energy in an ideal situation. It's used as building blocks, it's used as enzymes, it's used as other things, not to actually produce energy out of. So really saying that there's 4 calories in a gram of protein probably isn't true.
Yeah, it's very misleading.
Yeah.
And we did talk about that kind of more in depth with protein poisoning and just how you can't go eat chicken breasts all day every day. Even if you eat 2,000 calories of chicken breasts all day every day, you're not going to survive from that. You will literally starve. So the whole point, so as a whole, protein digestion is costly. So about 20 to 35% of the energy consumed from protein will go to simply breaking it down and assimilating it. So it's a big chunk just straight off the top that we're not going to get from energy. And like our body just simply doesn't want to use that for calories, like Tom said. So in comparison, it takes about 5% of the energy consumed from carbs or fats to digest them. So the bulk of their metabolism will go to supporting our overall metabolism. Like, our body wants to use carbs and fats for fuel. So that's what they're designed for. And because, here's a quote, because cooking can reduce the structural integrity of meat, eating cooked meat will involve a lower cost of digestion than eating raw meat. And that kind of goes into the proteins in meat. So collagen gives meat its rigidity, kind of makes it tough. So the tougher the meat, the more collagen it contains. Cooking heats up collagen and turns it into gelatin, making it softer. And I know that for a fact because I eat a bunch of heart. And the heart muscle actually has the most collagen of any muscle in the body. So go eat a bunch of heart and you'll it's chewy as shit, you know, because it's just so collagen dense. And
one thing I could think of is like when I make bone broth, like a bone, raw bone.
Yeah.
I can't bite into that. But by the time I'm done cooking my bone broth, those buns, those bones crumble in my hand. And I'm able to eat them. Like, I don't even need to chew them. I put them in my mouth and they just melt in my mouth.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on. And, it's funny. Talk about bone broth. We talked about, was it last week we talked about bone broth? The brands you recommended. It was like Kettle and Fire.
Kettle and Fire is, like, the most popular one that I know of.
And then you talked about, it was Epic, right?
I believe they make some. They're making it. They make everything else animal-based, so I'm willing to bet they make one too.
I stumbled across an Epic bone broth.
Okay.
Guess what was it? I popped the top of this Epic bone broth. The whole lid was covered in
fat.
It was fat and like gelatin. It was real gelatinous.
Okay.
And yeah. I was like,
that's the way it should be.
That's the way it should be. Exactly. And there's almost even like little meat bits still in it.
Okay.
And I was like, this is bone broth.
Yeah. I'm really surprised that that's how it comes out because the ones that I was buying, I've never tried Kettle and Fire, so I can't really speak to that
one. I have. It's all liquid.
It's all liquid and it's pretty much all protein.
Yeah.
And there's like no carbs, no fat in it either. So that's good that they actually make like one that I make at home.
Yes, exactly.
The one I make at home, like it's kind of like Jell-O. That's what it kind of looks like.
Yeah.
And there's chunks of meat in it just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah, so I just side, and actually they do, it's like a vinegar jalapeno blend type of thing.
Okay.
So it was like $6. It's expensive as shit for like a little jar. But I bought it because I was like, oh, I want to see what this is about. Tasted great.
Good.
And I was like, so if you see the brand Epic, go look for their bone broth. I actually really recommend it. If that's how bone broth should look. It should be gelatinous. It should be fatty. It should have little bits of shit flowing in it. You know what I mean? Just should.
Good to know.
Yeah. But, as far as testing the reduction and, like, lowering the cost of digestion part, there was a study done on pythons. And so you can take that with a grain of salt. I know we're not pythons. We're not even close to pythons. But apparently doing digestion studies on pythons is pretty easy because you can feed them one large meal, leave them in a room for a week, and just measure the like O2 consumption. Okay. So because pythons, they won't move, they're not going to starve, they'll just sit there, you know what I mean? So it's real easy to control for. So this is a quote from a python study. The cost of digestion was quantified from the cumulative postprandial oxygen consumption above standard metabolic rate. That is a hard sentence to say. We found that cooking reduced the cost of digestion by 12.7% of meal energy, grinding reduced the cost by 12.4%, and the effects of cooking and grinding were nearly additive, with the cooking and ground meal associated with a 23.4% reduction compared to the raw and whole treatment. So that's a pretty big chunk. And that makes sense that cooking is like pre-digestion. So it's doing that work for us.
Yeah, 23%. That's a really big number.
That's a really big number.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that going to equate directly one-to-one to humans? No. But is it somewhat, I don't know, can it somewhat be compared? Yeah, I think so. Because there is a study. Actually, it's not a study. It's more of just a unique study or a unique story, sorry, that happened in June 6th. 1822. Let me take you back to 1822. So a man was shot. This was accidentally like in a store, and a doctor happened to be nearby, and his doctor thought this dude was like dead. There was a hole blown in his chest. He was like toast. But the doctor, I guess, was a nice guy, took him home, and he nursed this dude back to health, and the dude actually survived. But for the rest of his life, he had a fist-sized hole in his stomach, like, well, in his abdomen, and it went straight into his stomach. So you can literally see the inside of this dude's stomach. And the doctor saw an opportunity to test digestion on this poor guy. He would literally tie strings of food, like on our tie food onto string and drop it into this dude's stomach and watch the digestive process of what would happen with all these different cuts of meat. And so we actually studied this guy for over 8 years and looked like really extensive notes on all this stuff. And he noted the more tender the food, the more rapidly and completely it was digested. And for meat, he said, if tender and finely divided, they are disposed of readily. If in large and solid mass, digestion is proportionally retarded. Minuteness of division and tenderness of fiber are the two grand essentials for speedy digestion. And that goes back to grinding and cooking as far as making things more tender and minuteness of division. So
smaller and softer, easier to digest.
Exactly. Yeah. So that kind of goes back to the Python study as far as the smaller and digester food lowered the cost of digestion by over 20%. So
maybe we can't take that 20% to be compared exactly to us, but mm-hmm. there's going to be some sort of reduction involved.
Exactly. Some sort of reduction.
Yeah. So chewing your food thoroughly. I've heard that so many times. Chewing your food thoroughly is a great way to aid with digestion. And cooking it apparently is a great way to aid in digestion as well.
Yep. So the fourth point was reducing immune upregulation. And this is a quote. So cooking kills foodborne pathogens like E. coli and Salmonella. If ingested live, these pathogens result in upregulation of the immune system, typically involving fever with measurable results. And that's the only quote I pulled from that. This actual study, and again, I'll link it to the website, outlined the literal amount of calories, like how often people would get sick if they ate raw meat. Then this is all not data. This is a kind of hypothesized.
Yeah.
Okay. And how many calories they would burn during fevers over the year. Like, this person would get sick 6 times if they ate cooked. They would get sick 12 times if they ate raw. And then they just calculated the calories. And it was, and not necessarily, I shouldn't have said sick because it's not what they meant. It was more of, we can eat these foods and our stomach is very acidic. It's going to kill most things, but our immune system might just have to work harder with some of these pathogens, and that work will generate into calories burned over the course of a lifetime of raw food eating. But the numbers were very complicated, and if I talked about it, it would have taken me like an hour. Okay. You know what I mean? But I do agree with it as far as reducing overall pathogens in the food. It's 100% true, and it makes sense, you know? Like you said, there was some guy in China who ate a bunch of sushi, and now he has a bunch of worms in his stomach.
I think it was over 70 different types of tapeworms or something like that.
From raw sushi. Or I guess all sushi's raw, but yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, well, that's probably something I want to cut back on. I don't eat a lot of sushi as is, but
yeah,
kind of glad I cut back on that a lot.
Yeah, I don't mess with sushi at all.
So one of the questions I asked earlier is like, okay, so cooking the fat, you lose 10% of your calories.
Yeah.
But then there's that potential that since pythons use 20% less energy to do it, maybe we are gaining calories.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Exactly, yeah. And the studies do mention that, few studies do mention that, like, because it's obvious if you're going to cook fat, or if you're going to cook meat, you're going to lose some fat. Like, it's just going to happen. The way you do it, searing it and then slow cooking it, is you're going to lose the least amount. So I don't know how much you're losing there, but it's very minimal. But they still say there's just not enough data to say either way, either that we lose calories by cooking or we gain calories by the lowering the cost of digestion. The answer is not out there yet. We just don't know.
Okay. So we talked about how it affects protein. We talked about how it affects carbs. So now we're going to look at some of the micronutrients. So vitamin C. So this is just done on plants. It's looking at broccoli, chard, potato, sweet potato, carrot, crown daisy. I have no idea what that is. Spinach, Perella leaf or Perea, I don't know what that is either, and zucchini. So a bunch of different vegetables, how different cooking methods affect it. So the results are either 0% or 113% are retained, depending on how it's cooked.
That's so crazy, by the way. Can you get a bigger range?
I know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So boiling it and blanching. Blanching is you basically boil it, and then once you're done with that, you throw it in ice cold water. So pretty much boiling and then like reducing the temperature really great. Mm-hmm. Those have the greatest reductions in vitamin C. So that's where like that 0% came from. Then steaming and microwaving had a much less reduction. And those are the four different cooking methods that they were testing. Boiling, blanching, steaming, and microwaving. So, and every vegetable had a completely different result. But pretty much the researchers concluded that since water or vitamin C is a water-soluble vitamin, the vegetable contact with the water had a significant impact on the loss of vitamin C. So if you're trying to get the most vitamin C out of your vegetables, either microwaving it or steaming it are the two best ways.
Got it. And that sounds so counterintuitive because everyone who, and again, people don't know, people's opinions are not informed, but a layman's point of view would say microwaving is kind of bad.
It's a machine. Like I've always kind of wondered, like, is it bad? I've never found anything that says that it's bad. I've heard that, like, you know, if you stand right next to it, you might get some microwave radiation. That could be bad.
Yeah.
But even that, I don't know if that's really true. I don't really see how it could be bad.
Yeah, I don't know.
From what I know, and I haven't come across anything conclusive.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say it's safe up until I find something that shows
off. Yeah, and it looks like as far as cooking goes, it does retain most of the nutrients.
Hey, microwaves came out pretty damn good on this study, or the studies that I looked at. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look at, I'm just going to put all these together because they pretty much have the same results. Beta carotene, which is a precursor to vitamin A. They can't do testing on vitamin A in plants because there isn't any. Vitamin E and vitamin K. All these are fat soluble. So those all came from the same studies. And basically 40 to 216% were retained. So the only way that something can be higher than 100% retained is basically the plant cell wall is destroyed or damaged. And that results in the more vitamin being available. So when we cook something, we destroy the or we damage the plant cell wall. So now we're able to access it. The control in all these tests was raw. So that whole raw vegan, you're actually not getting more vegetable or more vitamins out of the fruit. Once you damage that cell wall through cooking, now you're able to get a lot more vitamins from it. And that's true for water-soluble and fat-soluble vitamins.
Yeah, the cell wall is going to be made of something called cellulose. And guess what? Do we have the cellulase enzyme as humans?
No, we don't.
Sure as shit don't, raw vegans. So we can't break down cellulose. So we need something to break it down for us. So cooking is one of those options.
And they didn't really, there wasn't a conclusive way to tell like which cooking methods were better when it comes to fat-soluble vitamins. Because there was so much variance in every single vegetable out there. I didn't feel like getting into it. And I'm pretty sure you didn't want to listen to it either. So I just kind of just concluded that, hey, cooking vegetables is great for fat-soluble. Water-soluble, less contact with water.
Yeah, and also just reducing like surface area to the water. So if you're going to be cooking, I don't know, say like a carrot, maybe don't finely cut the carrot and then boil that shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's one of the tips. I have some tips at the end. That's one of them.
Oh, is it? Is that where I pulled that from in my head? Yeah, probably because I read that earlier. Yeah.
So like omega-3s. We talked about omega-6s, how omega-6s are impacted by fats, or, I mean by cooking, in an earlier podcast. It was probably like 10 podcasts ago, maybe more than that.
Yeah.
It was the industrial seed oil ones. Actually, I think that was like 20 podcasts ago now.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's a good one, though. Check it out.
So that's how it impacts that. So this is a study looking at how different cooking methods, boiling it, microwaving, canning, and frying affect omega-3 content in tuna. So boiling, which I had to look up, read through the damn details of this study, because they listed it as cooking. Just a little side note how frustrating that was.
Yeah.
Had the lowest impact. Pretty much no impact at all. Probably due to the low amount of heat that was actually applied. Because if you're boiling something, the water can only reach 200 and something degrees. Like, that can change very, like, a little bit because of the salt and the stuff in there, but it's not going to raise that temperature of the water up to 400 degrees or right. down to, like, 150 degrees Fahrenheit. So that water is going to stay at a relatively low temperature. So you're reducing the amount of heat that's applied to the fish.
It's funny you say that because the Inuit, their primary method of cooking is boiling.
Boiling is not very, like, attractive to food. Like, it does not make it taste good. Like, I'd much rather grill something than boil it.
Yeah.
But it seems like boiling it, but at least when it comes to fish, is the best way. Microwaving came in second. So, hey, microwave's not too bad. 25% of the EPA lost, 55% of DHA is lost.
And those are the two omega-3s you need to really be concerned with.
Yeah. Frying lost 70% of EPA and 85% of DHA. Again, I'm assuming that it's because when you fry something, you're raising the temperature to a very high amount. You don't fry stuff on low, you fry shit on high.
Yeah, and these omega-3 fats are polyunsaturated fats, so they have multiple points of weakness, so they're very prone to oxidation, which something like frying would oxidize these fats.
Which seems strange, because fried fish is delicious.
That's that Maillard effect?
Yeah.
Pronounce that shit right? You know I've said Maillard around you before, and I don't think you corrected me. You let me go 30-something years.
Maybe I thought you were talking about ducks or something.
Okay.
So the other way was canning, and this completely destroyed these fatty acids, but you had a take on that.
Yeah, I did. So I couldn't pull up the study or the article, but I know I read somewhere that as far as when anybody I work with or just people I talk to about tuna specifically, I always say the omega-3s in tuna will actually leach out into the fluid because it's a common practice. I know my mom did this my entire life. If you're going to open a can of tuna, they always drain the fluid first and then they eat the tuna. But I always tell them, just get that tuna, put it in a bowl, and stir it with the fluid, and hopefully some of the omegas will still be in that fluid. So you get some of that. You just don't pour all those healthy fats down the drain.
And that's the best part of eating fish, is that you're getting, that's like the highest amount of omega-3 content you can find.
That's what separates fish from like a steak. Like yeah. The protein quality are great on both of them, but you're not going to get crazy EPA or DHA from a steak or a chicken or anything really.
Yeah, anything on the land is going to be omega-6 dominant. Anything from the ocean or water at all is going to be omega-3 dominant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's the benefits of getting those. So just pretty much the conclusion on this. Different cooking methods have significantly different effects on everything, so it's really hard to nail it down into like one specific thing. So both water and fat are lost from cooking, which reduces the bioavailability of vitamins along with it. So if you're losing water, you're losing B vitamins and C vitamins. If you're losing fat, you're losing A, E, K. Is that all of them? I think that's all of them.
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or you're just losing... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, D's not really in anything, food-wise. A little bit in lard, a little bit in pork. The higher the heat exposure, the more damage you're going to be doing to omega-3 fatty acids. But when it comes to plants, high heat exposure is great for damaging cell walls, making vitamins from plants more bioavailable.
Yep.
And then just a side note, cooking does kill bacteria and parasites, greatly reducing the risk of foodborne illnesses. So that's another plus for cooking meat.
It is.
There's not a whole lot of studies on this. It's mostly just anecdotal evidence. So it's really kind of hard to like nail anything down for it. But when it comes to like ground meat, like ground beef, pork, and lamb, 160 degrees is that internal temp you want to look for like...
We're talking Fahrenheit, obviously.
Yeah. For chicken and turkey, 165. For like steaks, roasts, and chops, for like, you know, beef, pork, and lamb, looking at 145,
yeah.
So you can get away with those being a little rarer. And then seafood varies greatly. You pretty much just have to know by like looking at it and the texture of it. There really isn't like a guideline on like what the internal temperature should be on that.
Yeah, and that's something. There is a whole raw carnivore movement out there, and like I consider myself on a carnivore diet for a while now. I don't know. I bet my stomach is bulletproof. I really do. I think my stomach is very acidic. It should be at least. You know, I can put down pounds of meat, no problem. But I just don't have the balls to eat raw food because of those situations, you know?
Yeah, and actually after doing this, I don't really see any benefit of doing it.
Me either. Yeah.
Especially like after there's potential you're going to lose a little bit of fat, some water and stuff like that. But after I talk about these tips right here, you're going to see there's really like not a lot of benefit because it's really easy to overcome those losses.
Yeah.
So just some tips on retaining nutrients from cooking. So you use little to no water when cooking vegetables. That way you can retain the water-soluble vitamins B and C. So steaming or microwaving, great way to cook your vegetables. Also, like if you do cook like a steak or a roast or bacon or whatever, you know, all that leftover, that like fat and water that came out of it, use that to cook your vegetables in. That way those vegetables are going to absorb everything that was lost from the meat, and now you got all those vitamins lost. You
know? And it's going to taste better.
Yeah, you're using that as like a sponge. Also, like, cut after cooking to minimize the nutrient loss. So
that's a reducing surface area part.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, if you're cooking vegetables, cook them whole. And also, that's the same thing with meat. Like, if you're going to, like, make a roast, it's better to make a roast and then to cut it into steaks later. Or... you know, just anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, cook a steak whole and then slice it after. I think most people generally do that.
Anyways, yeah.
And then this is just something that I do. You can drink, like, the remaining liquid, like, after you cook the vegetables. So, like, I stir fry, like, mushrooms or zucchini, broccoli, something like that. I'll, like, do a little stir fry, cook them in some butter. And then instead of pouring them in a plate, I normally pour them in a bowl. And then after I'm done eating it, there's just, like, this buttery, like, liquid at the bottom. And I always drink it.
Yeah.
It's delicious.
Yeah, that's actually good. I bet that tastes better than what I'm about to say. So, I've been eating a lot of tri-tip lately. If you follow me on Instagram, you know that. I've been doing tri-tip roast to my damn self just every day, like, multiple pounds of it. And, I've been cooking it in an Instant Pot with bone broth, right? I bought some Kettle and Fire bone broth, and so I put the bone broth in there, cook it, and then I drink the bone broth after cooking the tri-tip in it.
I know Jimmy Morris talked about doing that.
Really?
Before he went carnivore, when he was just doing like keto,
mm-hmm.
he used to cook all his vegetables in bone broth and said it was delicious, and you do the same thing.
Really? Okay. Yeah, that's what I do. It just tastes like really steaky water.
Yeah,
that sounds gross, but it's really not that bad.
I mean, it doesn't sound bad to me, but maybe it does to other people. Yeah, that does sound good. Mm-hmm. And then this is something else, kind of like the same thing. So I'll cook my meat first, and then if I'm gonna cook vegetables, I'll cook the vegetables in whatever is like left over from that meat. Cook it in the same pan, or if the vegetables are gonna take a little bit longer to cook, I'll cook them separate and then add everything together in the same pan, just so those vegetables can soak up all the fat and water, all those vitamins lost from the meat, and then just kind of act as a sponge. It not only does it make them taste so much better, but now they're also just a lot more nutritious. So anything that is lost is lost through the air and not in the liquid that's remaining at the bottom of the pan.
Yeah.
So those are, instead of a tip of the week, I just kind of gave you quick little four or five.
No, that's good. No, that's really good tips. Yeah. So overall, I think cooking is beneficial. I think cooking is the way to go. And can we eat raw meat? 100%. Have we been eating raw meat longer than cooked meat? 100%. Honestly, by millions of years. But by this age of the game, cooking does provide benefits to meat. I don't really care about how cooking affects vegetables, because guess what? Don't eat vegetables, right? So I don't really give a shit about the water and the surface area and all that stuff. But as far as meat goes, personally, after doing the research, I think it is beneficial to cook meat. And that's how I do it. You know, that's how I'm going to continue to do it.
Yeah, I think we would have stopped doing it a long time ago if it was bad.
Yes.
Like, if there weren't a lot of benefits to it. And obviously that there are. I've heard of people talking about feeling some sort of high after eating raw meat. Unfortunately, I don't know anybody that does that, so I don't really know how to explain it. And we tried talking about it earlier, and we had no answers for it.
No answers, yeah. It would be really cool to talk to a raw carnivore. And I don't know, maybe that's something we can look into in the future. Talk, maybe get an interview with a guy or a lady who does that. But I don't know how many are out there. I know there are, though. I see it, so.
Yeah, so yeah, basically cooking meat is really beneficial. I don't really see anything wrong with it. I thought there would be a lot more detriments to it than what we found out, but it really seems like there's like none.
Yeah, pretty much none. Yeah, and yeah, like, you were the one who proposed this podcast because you were interested in what would happen, you know? And we found out, not much.
Yo, I really wanted to do this one for a podcast we're going to do in the next couple weeks, talking about how like, cooking meat affects, like, dogs, because that's something that I'm interested in. Because I feed my dogs, like, cooked meat, but I see all the time, like, oh, no, you need to do raw, you know, like, if you cook your meat, you're destroying all the nutrients. Well, we just did this. No, you're not.
No, you're not.
And then every person that's asked, like said that, I've asked them, well, do you eat raw meat then? And nobody's given me an answer. Oh, yes, I do.
Yes.
And normally it's either a no response or it's, oh, it's not the same thing.
Sure shit is, bro.
It is the same thing.
It is the same thing. Guess what? Dog and a wolf, damn near identical. We have the same exact GI tract. How meat affects a dog is going to affect us the exact same way. So
yeah, and if you don't want to say, like, humans and dogs are the same, well, then it's kind of like, well, you have to get rid of almost every single nutritional study or pretty much every biology study out there, because we do very little testing on humans. We do almost every single testing on dogs, mice, rabbits, pythons, apparently.
Apparently.
That's a new one to me.
Me
but
too.
We do all these testing on animals to figure out how our own biology works. So if you don't want to make those comparisons, then you shouldn't have any knowledge whatsoever when it comes to anything biology-based.
Yeah, then our textbooks would be blank.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like, you need, yeah, maybe everything's not a one-to-one comparison, but it's not completely irrelevant either.
No, it's definitely not. Yeah, exactly. And it's close as shit when it comes to dogs, straight up. So, yeah, so if you're a dog fan, you've got dogs out there, I know a lot of people do, make sure to check out that podcast in the next few weeks. But yeah, that's another podcast in the books. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns, feel free to reach out.
Yeah, and if you feel like supporting the podcast, go to our homepage on our website, TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. There's a donate button towards the bottom. It's a bright yellow button. Or if you want to show your support another way, please rate and subscribe on your favorite podcast provider, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or YouTube. Thank you, and have a happy and healthy week.